bitter confrontation between Islamism and the West continues to dominate our newspapers and bulletins this week. Today we're going to be looking at a slight but steady gleam of hope. Is the long-awaited modernization of Islam inside the Muslim world just beginning in Saudi Arabia? The Saudis are the key Western ally in the region, and yet the House of Saud is accused of spreading extremism and terrorism beyond its borders and authoritarian control inside them. Madawa al-Rashid is a London-based specialist in the religious politics of Saudi Arabia. Her new book is called Muted Modernists. She's joined today by Sir William Patey, who is Britain's ambassador in Saudi Arabia, as well as in Iraq and Afghanistan, by Deirdre McCluskey, a pioneer in the economics of ideas, and by Ian Morris, whose work on the ups and downs of civilizations, Why the West Rules for Now, has been avidly read around the world. A heavyweight team, then, for one of the most serious issues confronting us, Islam's ability to change itself from the inside. Now then, Madawi, we have this vision of Saudi Arabia. There's the House of Saud on the one hand, authoritarian, very rich, highly politically conservative, and there's the Wahhabis on the other hand, exporting jihadis around the world and dangerous. But you would argue that is a very, very simplistic view of modern Saudi society.
Good morning. You're absolutely right. In the public sphere, we see these two images of Saudi Arabia. But I chose to write about a new trend that had been brewing under the surface in Saudi Arabia. And these are modernists who are trying to explain and reinterpret the Islamic tradition. So if there are like three words that summarize what's going on among this particular group of Saudis, it is reform, because they seek reform and they want a political reform that would actually minimize the prospect of having this terrorism and the radicalization that goes on inside Saudi Arabia first. The second thing they want to do is to reinterpret the Islamic tradition from within. So they deal with foundational texts in Islam in order to come to interpretation that suit the modern world. And unfortunately, the third R is repression. They work as groups of intellectuals and activists, but under conditions of extreme repression. Unfortunately, most of the people I discuss in this book are in prison today, serving long prison sentences between 10 and 15 years, and followed by ban on travel. So what do they want? They want to change the current political system from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional monarchy. They have been engaged in the global discourse on human rights, on civil society. They want democracy, they want transparency, end of corruption. So how do they do that without actually borrowing too much from the West? What they do is go back to the Islamic texts, the Quran, the tradition of the Prophet, and offer new interpretation that would allow, for example, to open up the political system for greater representation, for accountancy, and for transparency.
And just to interrupt there, the argument is, among some people, that the Quran encourages absolute obedience to secular rulers. And they argue that this is a misreading.
Absolutely, because as a world religion, as a text that is written by people in different times, different places, the Quran itself is subject to multiple interpretations. And the Saudi official Wahhabi, that is the religious establishment, offers one interpretation and wants everybody to abide by this interpretation. And that is that Muslims should offer complete obedience to their rulers, and there is a ban on any kind of dissent, even if it's a tweet or writing a pamphlet or establishing a civil society. Demonstrations are banned in Saudi Arabia. So the modernists I look at offer reinterpretation of, for example, the most interesting concept, and that is jihad. So today we talk about jihad as a way of fostering violence among people, but they argue that there is a kind of everyday peaceful jihad that is a place to struggle and achieve your full potential as a human being.
We might call it democracy. It's, however, very, very easy to get these people wrong. They're called the Tanwiris.
They are called the Tanwiris simply because they offer a new interpretation to these old religious texts.
Right, but it's very easy for us to say, aha, here comes the Muslim Reformation, and we've been talking about, you know, parallels with the 30 years war and so forth. This is the moment of enlightenment and reformation inside Islam, but you argue that this is a dangerous misreading of what's going on.
The idea of Reformation has a strong Christian European history, and therefore it is very difficult to impose it on the world of Islam, simply because Islam itself as a text does not have an official religious establishment that dominate, and therefore interpretations tend to be outside that religious establishment. Because there is no church in Islam, it has undergone through the ages into a constant reformation. However, unfortunate for the reformers, they always end up in prison.
Deirdre McCoskey.
Well, the early reformers in Europe in the 16th century, some of them were just like that. They were against any sort of hierarchy. They wanted individual congregations to choose who preached. They were trying to get back to what they regarded as early Christianity, which sounds very much like Islam as you describe it.
Strip away the kind of hierarchies,
no popes, no bishops. That was the radical Reformation.
Yes, but in Islam this has been going on from the early days, simply because there isn't an established religious group who dominate interpretation in Islam. And therefore the text is subject to interpretation and reinterpretation all the time.
But of course it's true in radical Protestantism even now, that idea that I get to decide on what the text means, and that I think is the, just as you say in your book, that's the source of our freedoms.
Sir William Petty.
I wondered, having read your book, I wondered if this was a very Saudi-specific thing rather than a movement that could spread to Islam more widely, because it was about the Saudi experience. Could we oppose the current version of what Islam means in Saudi Arabia and its pact, if you like, with the monarchy? This sounded very Saudi-specific, constitutional monarchy, easing up on some of the restrictions, of sort of, I hesitate to the word after your injunction, it's a Western concept, liberal interpretation of Islam. But is it broader, or is it Saudi specific, about the Saudi specific experience?
Actually, Saudi Arabia is a latecomer to this debate. It has started in the Muslim world centuries ago, and some people might return to the medieval period when this kind of reinterpretation using rational argument to interpret the sacred text. But Saudi Arabia is a latecomer, and this is because of the dominance of the Salafi Wahhabi tradition that basically does not accept any kind of reinterpretation of text. They want a literal interpretation under the auspices of the religious establishment.
Ian Morris.
I think, I mean, the question about whether we should talk about a Muslim Reformation is an interesting one. I think all of these historical analogies, they bring with them some insight and some confusion. I think one of the reasons we talk about the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century is that the reformers kind of won. There have been plenty of challenges to the Christian church before, but on the whole, the reformers lost. And I can't help but think that if a reformist movement does win out in the Muslim world, we will talk about a Muslim Reformation. And if it doesn't, it gets relegated back to just kind of this background noise of constant struggles.
It may win in some parts of the Muslim world. So, for example, in Indonesia, they tend to have a reformist tradition that went to early 20th century and even before that. In Egypt, they had a reformation, in inverted commas, in the late 19th century. But the specific Saudi situation did not allow this kind of reinterpretation of religious texts.
And is that because of the famous deal done between the House of Saud as rulers and the Wahhabi tradition in faith? In other words, each supports the other as the two sort of pillars of Saudi society.
Absolutely. I mean, it is not in the interest of the Al Saud rulers to have an intellectual activist trend to call for constitutional monarchy or an elected government. And therefore, its alliance with the Wahhabis is purely in the self-interest of both groups. They ban all demonstrations, new opinions, reformist ideas, and therefore there is no challenge, at least at the intellectual level. And when people want to be activists, for example, engage in civil society, they are put in prison. And therefore the two groups, the Al Saud and the Wahhabis, work together as almost like an orchestra, trying to keep the repression and keep these kind of modernist trends under the surface or in prison.
Which leads to the obvious question, Madawi. So you describe in the book some very sophisticated, brave, intelligent modernizers, or reformists, how we describe them. But how influential are they, given that they're in prison most of the time? There is social media, there are tweets, there are circulations of their work and their ideas, but are they really influential, or are they a tiny, successfully repressed group?
They are successfully repressed, but in my view, and I could see it by following what's going on in Saudi Arabia, that you could put the reformists in prison, but their ideas can never be put in prison. And therefore, they're spread, assisted by new social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And eventually, they will influence a new generation of young activists, as they have done. Of course, there is no activism to pressurize the government to free them, simply because the cost is very high for activists.
And so just explain to us what kind of people these are. Are they Saudi scholars? Are they university academics? Who are they?
Most of them are a mixture of religious cleric, which is really interesting because nobody in the current situation in the world would think that a religious cleric or ulama would come up with modernist ideas, but Salman al-Ouda is one of them. The others are professors at universities, some of them are lawyers, and also young activists who are mainly educated. So what I'm describing in the book is a middle class intellectual activist who have engaged with the global discourse on human rights, civil society and democracy in order to change their own situation
and
in the
been
country.
Stomped on as a result. Is there anything that we in the West can do to help them?
Well, there are two Wests, as far as I'm concerned.
Talking about
the
one Radio 4, of course.
There are two Wests. There's the official West that is represented by governments in the West, and they tend to have hands off. They don't want to interfere because they're worried about the fall of the House of Saud. And so therefore, flogging, beheading, all that, it's a no-go area for Western governments. And they claim that they could put pressure on the Saudi regime to free some of these reformers through sort of behind the door diplomacy, as I heard it several times. But also there is the Western civil society. And it had been wonderful, taking the causes of Saudi political prisoners, prisoners of conscience, and mobilizing civil society at the global level. I think we have to keep the pressure on the Saudi government, and Saudi government cares a lot about its reputation in the West. It's almost like to a pathological case. They don't like criticism in the West of their own political system and domestic affairs. And therefore, I have faith in the global civil society to keep the causes of those political prisoners alive.
Madawi, you have perfectly teed up Sir William Beatty, former ambassador in Saudi. Sir William, I suppose a lot of people listening will say, well, we hate what goes on, we hate the threatened crucifixions and the floggings and the beheadings and so forth. Why aren't we really, really tough on the Saudis? Why are they our allies? Or, to put it the other way, what would happen to the whole region if the House of Saud itself fell?
I think the cost of instability in Saudi Arabia and the current situation would be very profound indeed, not just for Britain. I mean, I always wonder why Britain is the one that has to fix Saudi Arabia, how it's always Britain's responsibility. Yeah, I think we didn't break it, we didn't even form it. It was never a British colony. So I always love the presumption that it's Britain's responsibility to do something about Saudi Arabia. What I was struck with Madawi's book is that nobody in Britain, either in the government or in civil society, could possibly understand Saudi Arabia well enough to have an influence over what happens. And unless the Saudis decide that they want to change, what we do is irrelevant. And I was struck when I was in Saudi Arabia in the 90s, Salman al-Ouda was a kind of Salafi dissident. And it's quite interesting to see his evolution, because he would have been regarded as a pretty much an extremist, even more extreme than some of the establishment. So, you know, the trends that are going on in Saudi Arabia are way beyond the ken of the civil society in Britain or even the government. So, I mean, I think the government's view is these interests are broad-based. There is engagement with Saudi Arabia on human rights. We, I think, would like to see the sort of evolutionary reform in Saudi Arabia, the development of a constitutional monarchy. That would not be against Britain's interests in the region. But we're a bit stuck for ideas on how we can actually change anything.
But what they have got over us, I suppose, is the prospect, the actual fall of the House of Saud and the collapse of Saudi Arabia and the arrival of an ISIS-style radical movement there would be a total catastrophe for the West, with all of those oil fields with Mecca and Medina and so forth.
Absolutely, and I think one of the
a final Middle Eastern catastrophe.
Yes, I think one of the problems is that the kind of reformist movement that Madawi has described in her book, The Mutin Modernist, most people in the West would say, yes, these are all good things to have. Within Saudi Arabia, it might be seen as more like the Muslim Brotherhood, the using the channels of democracy to establish what is far from a democratic site, and what they're very clear where the Muslim Brotherhood's ultimate goal is. It's the caliphate, and it's born out on the same kind of ideology and philosophy that led to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, frankly. So the Arab Spring, in many ways, has made people even more reluctant in places like Saudi Arabia to take a chance, because we've seen in some countries that the reformers make the breakthrough, but they're not the beneficiaries of the aftermath.
Meanwhile, talk us a little bit through the politics of the House of Saud itself, because we're very familiar with dynastic struggles and brother against brother and so forth, if we're talking about the Tudors or the Plantagenets or the Stuarts or whatever. But the House of Saud situation is not totally dissimilar and very interesting just at the moment.
It is interesting at the moment, and I've often said, privately, it's no longer private, I'm just about to say it here, that the real threat to Saudi Arabia is not from revolution from below, not from external, not from coups or anything, but from dissension within the royal family. And if the royal family were to break up into factions, a la the Tudors and the Plantagenets, that would represent the greatest threat. Now, they've often been very good at overcoming their differences and agreeing on through a sort of consensual basis who should lead. There just seems to be a lot more churn in public at the moment than there has been traditionally.
So where should we be looking? And there's the new king. Are we talking about brothers of his or cousins as the other factions in the family?
Well, I think you've got a very young deputy crown prince in Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Unprecedented for someone so young in Saudi Arabia to have so much power, that inevitably will produce a degree of resentment. You have someone in the hierarchy, his cousin Mohammed bin Nayef, who is the crown prince and who we would expect to be the king. And then you've got Prince Ahmed, who's still one of the surviving sons of Abdulaziz and is in the line for the throne, although he's been put aside, if you like, at the moment. So you could see how, if there was factions, they could rally around particular figures. I don't think that has happened, but there are signs of it.
And at some point, possibly, one of those figures, one of those factions might pick up muted modernists and the change makers, and that might be their great moment if part of the royal family says, actually, we do need some more reform from inside.
I'd be surprised if they did.
Okay.
I think the reformers are
just a kind of sunny
optimist.
Historically,
it did happen in the 1960s. Prince Talal ibn Abdul Aziz, he was declared himself a free prince and took the idea of the constitutional monarchy, and he was in exile in Egypt.
And he was quickly sidelined by the rest of the family.
I think we can rule all these possibilities.
Fascinating stuff, Ian Morris.
I mean, what you say does leave me wondering what you think Western governments should be doing. Because, I've been living in the US for half my life now, and it was sort of disturbing in the Arab Spring, watching the kind of thrashing around, as I saw it, within the Obama administration. Because on the one hand, you've got a character like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, who's been, in many ways, he's been a very good friend of America for a very long time, a strong strategic partner. And yet, it's really difficult for an elected leader in a Western democratic government to say, yeah, I'm going to stick with my buddy, the British dictator. The way I think Putin can say this, I'm going to stick with Assad, come what may. And I can't help but I felt like the US government was trying to pull up a clever compromise and be on everybody's side at once, and sort of ended up with the typical compromise being the worst of all possible outcomes.
Yeah, well, I think, and that struck the Saudis, the alacrity with which the West and the United States
dumped Mubarak.
They were worried about that. And then I think the aftermath of the Arab Spring, if you like, has caused Western leaders to check and think, hold on, we did want to be on the right side of the tide of history, but where would that lead us in places like Saudi Arabia? So unfortunately for Madawi, it's reinforced the view that we're not going to take chances with Saudi Arabia's stability, and I think that's part of the issue.
Madawi.
Well, there's one thing. From the very moment Saudi Arabia was created and declared the kingdom in 1932, the British, who were very involved, yes, they didn't colonize Saudi Arabia, but they were very involved. Ibn Saud was on the payroll of the British for at least 20 years. So let's not forget that.
Everybody
and from that moment, the British were convinced that there are nasty people there in Central Arabia, and our best bet should be on Ibn Saud, who keeps them under control. And that was the deal, and it's still, unfortunately, in the 21st century, we are still subscribing to this kind of policy in Britain and in Washington as well. But given that we have witnessed the outburst of Saudi religious effervescence and zealotry throughout the world, especially in the last 3-4 decades, I'm still surprised that there are people in the corridors of power in London and Washington who still believe that the Al Saud are our shield and they provide us with security. We cannot hold them responsible for anything, it seems. Even when 15 of the hijackers who stormed New York on the 11th of September happened to be Saudi, just imagine if they had come from another Arab country, what would have happened?
Well, I think it's very flattering to think that you think that Britain is responsible or that Britain could do anything about it. As a former diplomat, we'd love to think we had that much power, but the reality is very, very different. And I think, you know, because to blame Saudi Arabia and all Saudis because some of the hijackers were Saudi, they came from a tradition, a Salafist Wahhabi tradition in Jihad, but to say that that is the Saudi government, I think is a big stretch.
However, you go around the world and you find the spread of more extreme versions of Islam, and very often the Saudi money behind it. I'm thinking, for instance, Bangladesh, where the Saudis have been pouring money in, and Pakistan as well. And if we are worried about extreme conservative interpretations of Islam then producing some kind of violent jihadists, then presumably the Saudis are responsible for that.
And we should challenge that. I think we have done. I mean, Madawi may poo-poo the quiet diplomacy, but I can tell you...
As a quiet diplomat,
but in my time in Saudi Arabia, we have engaged with Saudi Arabia on the prevalence of extremist teaching, in our view, in British mosques. And I think it's perfectly right, and we should continue to do that. If we see evidence of Salafist teaching being financed out of Saudi Arabia under the guise of Islamic spreading the word of Islam, then we should challenge it, and we do, and I think that is important.
Now, the other thing, of course, about the House of Saud is they are fabulously, fabulously wealthy, and this brings us on to the question of whether just sheer capital accumulation is something that will allow modernisation or get in the way, and the extent to which ideas are important. Deirdre, your work has been really on the undervalued historical importance of ideas in the capitalist revolutions around the world.
Absolutely. The sheer accumulation of oil wealth is not going to be so sheer very soon. It will run out, and Saudi Arabia is on the margin of the world economy. And if it's going to succeed for its people, it has to adopt free enterprise, along with which goes, I claim, freedom generally.
So if there's a deficit there, it's an ideas deficit, it's a freedom deficit.
Yes, and exactly as has been discussed here, it's the ideas of the unity of Islamic states and religions, which sounds very familiar to a European historian, I must say. There isn't anything weird about the situation in Saudi Arabia or the Middle East.
Except perhaps that it's got so much oil. And it is sometimes said the worst thing that can happen to a country is to suddenly strike large quantities of oil or gas or indeed any other natural resource that actually makes it holds the country back rather than brings it forward.
Well, it makes the government independent of taxation. it as the government is able to
do what it wants.
It wants, and this happened in Nigeria. It happens all over the place.
Yeah, Ian Morris, I remember when you did Why the West Rules for Now. You had a kind of calculus of the amount of energy used as a kind of unit of modernization. Did you find any connection between finding that having lots of natural resources and a lack of modernization rather than the reverse?
Well, not really. I think it's like Saudi Arabia and the other oil-rich countries they're a little bit of an anomaly in the history of energy and the organization of societies. So, on the whole, throughout history, places where people have been able to generate the largest amounts of energy have tended to be the richest, most powerful countries in the world. But the way it happened in the Middle East, of course, is a little bit different.
But if they already have, as Deirdre was suggesting, some kind of open or liberal system which allows the development. So Britain is built on coal and so forth, and that's very important for the Industrial Revolution, the iron and so forth, but it already has a relatively open and liberal constitution when those discoveries are made.
Yeah, I think that makes all the difference. I mean, economists talk a lot about the resource curse. If you have a lot of oil, you are automatically the terrible rulers and so on. But that's not how it works. I mean, Norway didn't turn into Nazi Germany when they found North Sea oil, and Saudi Arabia didn't turn into Norway when they found oil. I think the wealth allows the rulers to do what they want to do. And if you're in a country like Saudi Arabia, which before the 20th century is a very, very traditional place, I mean, it's been sort of bypassed by a lot of the big forces in history, suddenly they have all this wealth and they're able to do exactly what they want to do. Except that they live in a world where the real centres of power are kind of outside their society, and they always have to negotiate with these outside.
You were saying earlier on that you're an adoptive American. Other important part of this story, of course, is the Saudis do an absolutely crucial strategic deal with the Americans. You get your oil, we get our protection, we get our military. So the American military-industrial complex, as it's sometimes called, is absolutely sewn into the stability or otherwise of the House of Saud.
Yes, so I think this is something where Saudi Arabia does have a lot in common with quite a few other countries. They are all the way from China to the Mediterranean. Now, for most of history, these countries were the richest, most powerful in the world. Then, abruptly, after the Europeans, around 1500, start getting ships and guns that allow them to go all over the world doing more or less what they want. These societies all experience rather similar sorts of breakdown and collapse of the traditional order. And the ones that have flourished in the 20th century tended to be the ones that have figured out a way to cooperate and work with the Western powers. And so, like, say, China, after the fall of Mao Zedong, they work out, well, we can flourish, our economy can grow, if we accept our place within a global system dominated by the Americans. We don't challenge it too much, we work with the Americans, things will go well for us.
Nixon arrives and all of that.
Exactly, they'd encourage that. And the Saudis, I mean, what they've done, of course, is very different from what Mao did. But, looking at it in terms of the structures of how the whole thing works, they've gone in sort of a similar direction. So, the Americans are the big power on the block. We prefer them to the Soviet Union. We're going to do better with them as our ally. So how can we do all the things we want while still making the Americans love us without letting the Americans sort of tell us what to do? And in some ways, I think you can say, whatever else you might say about them, they've been very, very skillful at playing this game.
So William Pitt.
And what is happening at the moment is that that Saudi view, which has persisted for quite a long time, I think they were much more interested in what the Americans said from the 1930s, when we passed up the chance to develop all that nice oil. The Saudis are feeling that America is no longer as interested in its energy and its oil than it used to be. So they're beginning to see US shale oil is producing as much, and then Saudi Arabia is no longer the biggest exporter of oil to Saudi to the United States. So they're beginning to feel the pressure that perhaps the US is less interested in the Middle East and will be less willing to come to their aid. The Americans, of course, say, it's true to a great extent, we have much wider interests in the stability in the global energy market. But as China takes more and more of Saudi's oil, they're looking to the future. You would expect China to play a bigger role in the Middle East.
So Deirdre McCluskey, taking a kind of longer picture role, here we have a country which is going to become less important economically in the global system.
Yes.
Sir William's right, I'm sure he is, and is also lacking in the ability to reform itself fast enough from inside, unless these muted modernists we started off talking about become much more powerful, much more quickly.
Well, I'm more optimistic. because we've seen this before, over and over again, and it's if you were to go to Holland in 1610, you would find exactly the same struggles between interpretations of a holy text.
The House of Orange, if not the House of Saud.
The House of Orange and the House of Saud. The House of Orange, like the House of Saud, was clever for many generations, but was not a consistently progressive force. Yet in the end, it worked out. And it worked out not because of resources or energy or oil, which we obsess about too much. It worked out from the idea of freedom for individuals, which
and thus the growth
radical
of middle classes.
Well, yes, it was completely radical in the 16th century. Hierarchy was the rule, and then it gradually fell.
Ideas. Ian, you were nodding very excitedly at that.
Yeah, well, Andrew, I think you were right to bring up the issue of China. I think it's very difficult to think about what's happening in the Middle East without thinking about the rise of China at the same time. And I feel that the sort of questions we're talking about here, there's always three levels you've got to look at them on. One is the local level, the sort of thing Madawi has written about so wonderfully in her book. And then there's a regional level, the struggle between the different Middle Eastern powers. Obviously, Saudi Arabia and Iran is one of the growing rivalries everybody talks about. And then there's the global scale as well. And as power and wealth, a lot of people think, shifts from the United States toward China, we're going to see all kinds of consequences for the regional and local levels as well. And you know, can't help but suspect that this is something that might benefit the House of Saud.
I was picking up on Deirdre's point about innovation, and there is change going on in Saudi Arabia. I think there is a kind of recognition that oil may not always be Saudi Arabia's best friend and it will run out. I mean, I've been in presentations in Saudi Arabia where they accept that we didn't run out of coal, we stopped using it.
Yes.
And that the world may not run out of oil, they may stop using it. So they're kind of trying to be on a path of change that would make them independent. And I think some of the things are holding them back, but I think there are other things happening. 140,000 graduates, as Madawi talks about in her book, educated overseas, are going to have an impact on the development of Saudi Arabia. And indeed, I think there is a recognition that the West, that its strength is as much about its innovation, its intellectual property. And there are moves afoot. King Abdullah University for Science and Technology is a deliberate attempt from the top down to encourage innovation and the acquisition of intellectual property.
So this is really interesting. So I think Bahrain, for instance, is spending a huge amount of money at the moment of its oil wealth on education, trying to make itself an education.
Qatar particularly.
And Qatar, and I think Qatar above all, yes. And the Russians are building a big new university and science campus outside Moscow and so on. It's going on all around the world. When you are on the way down, you've got your oil money, the first thing you have to do is to produce more innovation, more intellectual capital. Is there much sign of that? But are we in Saudi?
Well, the problem is as our sort of focus shifts to China, it is very interesting because there are people in Saudi Arabia who would argue that the most important thing is economic growth, and we could do this with repression.
Right.
So this is the biggest
Chinese
question.
Chinese can do it, so can we.
Exactly. Yeah. And therefore, is it possible, is it really possible to have economic growth without the rule of law? Is it possible to have economic enterprise and growth, you know, attract foreign investment when you don't have accountability? You don't have transparency. So there are certain checks on this model that we could actually become really provide jobs, have innovation at the economic level and enterprise, but without liberalizing, in inverted commas, the political system. Is it really possible? We will see. If China could do it, then the Saudis, some sections in Saudi society, think that they can. But in my view, I think without freedom to innovate, without fear, without repression, it is very difficult to create a society that can sustain itself in the post-oil era.
And yet, Ian Morris, you said that the rise of China might benefit the House of Saud. Why you said for that reason, because they have a model of modernization with repression. Is that what you meant by that?
Well, I think yeah, I mean, certainly that's one way in which it works. I think another way though is that, what the Chinese will often refer to is the kind of Beijing consensus, that you're unlike the way in which many Western countries will work with governments overseas. China seems much more willing to say that what goes on within your country is your business. It's none of our business.
Behead away.
Exactly, yes. You want to flog people, fine, flog people. We don't care. And I think that, if you are a repressive government, that has got to look more attractive than the kind of package that you often get when you're dealing with Western countries. And I think also just the simple fact, having two big customers has got to be better for their oil, it's got to be better for the Saudis than only one.
So William, is this part of the sort of long, slow, declining roar of Western influence pulling back, that actually as the Chinese are able to offer a more attractive deal to repressive regimes? People like yourself, as it were, the current ambassadors in the UK and the Western countries, have less leverage, less purchase.
We shall have less leverage, I think, and the Saudis find China a much more comfortable partner. But there is, I'd like to, there is actually a model. What they have seen in China is that while they've maintained political stability through a very strict control, they've introduced economic freedoms, yeah. and Saudi is doing that actually. Mm. In a way, it leads to stability because the elite, the economic elite within Saudi Arabia, which goes beyond the royal family, are actually pretty happy with the status quo. So you see economic liberalisation in Saudi Arabia, and I don't mean just privatisation to the princes. I mean things like the stock market, the introduction of joint stock companies, limited liability, the sorts of things that appeal to companies is being introduced in Saudi Arabia. So in a way, they are going down the China model.
Madawi, let's return to the politics again. What is the effect of all of these students coming back? Because there are a lot of Saudi students all around the world, in Britain, in the United States and so forth. Most of them come home again, and presumably they bring in ideas which are not congenial to the current regime or the Wahhabi.
Yeah, well, that's if they find jobs. This is the problem. I mean, there is a very high unemployment rate in Saudi Arabia, and not all those people who are educated in the West or locally end up with jobs. The government introduced so many schemes, social benefits and unemployment benefits, in order to calm them down. And this is the youth of the country. And let's not forget, 60% of the Saudi population is under the age of 30. Plus, the government has a vested interest in keeping the foreign migrant workers flowing into Saudi Arabia to take all sorts of jobs, from the menial to the most advanced. These are people who have precarious existence. They're not unionized. They can be hired and fired. And therefore, the government shields itself from a labor movement if it provides wider access to employment.
Sounds a little familiar in some respects, Deirdre.
Youth unemployment is the great explosive force underneath most societies in the world. It's very concerning. You can open a stock market and have MBAs and so forth, but if you don't have a free market in labor, in which ordinary and not so ordinary people can find employment, you won't have a progressive economy. And you will have, as in Greece and South Africa and lots of other places, an explosive, not exactly underclass, the pilots in the 9/11 attack were all educated.
So
and with high aspirations.
With high aspirations, which they couldn't fulfill.
So we come back to demography as fate, Ian Morris.
Yeah, I think that is often the big driving force pushing things forward. I mean, with respect to this business about the educated Saudis returning to Saudi Arabia, an interesting experience last year. I taught for a few days at a business school in the University of Zurich, and mostly Swiss people in an MBA program. And a number of them were heavily engaged in business in Saudi Arabia. And they said, pretty much overwhelmingly, what they said was they found highly educated Saudi businessmen, always men, of course, who come to Switzerland and are perfectly happy behaving just the same as other Swiss business people, having a drink in the evenings, sitting around in t-shirts and jeans, and then they go back to Saudi Arabia, and they have no interest in behaving that way in Saudi Arabia. The way things are currently going is pretty satisfactory to them. And they said they were all really
surprised.
So
this is all about people living in two places. It's an economy which depends on migrant workers, but yet can't find jobs for its own educated people, and its elite depend upon being able to leave the kingdom and to do the things they want and then come back to work.
But this is the dilemma of opening up to the world like Saudi Arabia has done, imported every Western technology, but there is a problem with the values that go with this technology, that you cannot actually import easily because values can't be imported. They mutate, they spread, some of them are rejected, others are accepted. And therefore, what you describe, Ian, is very typical of this kind of situation where you live in multiple worlds at the same time. You have the technology, the gadgets of modernity, but without the values that go with modernity.
And it doesn't work. Sir William?
I think Saudis are very good at living in multiple worlds. They're very good at living in Saudi Arabia with some of the restrictions that they take as normal, and then enjoy some of the freedoms outside. But I think the big challenge for Saudi Arabia is going to be the young and whether they can find jobs. I mean, the advantage of having 10 million foreign workers is there's quite a lot of jobs that can be replaced by Saudis. So if you do it right and you have an opportunity and you introduce the right policies, it doesn't necessarily mean political freedom, but introduce policies that produce employment for Saudis, you've probably got a recipe for continued stability.
Madawi, how long before women are able to drive in Saudi Arabia, very briefly?
Well, the question for me and for many Saudi women is not whether they are allowed to drive, is whether some of them can afford to buy a car.
Ah, okay. All right, back to economics. Thank you all very much. Fascinating. Madawi al-Rashid's Muted Modernists, The Struggle for Divine Politics in Saudi Arabia is out now. William Pate is writing about Saudi Arabia in this month's Prospect magazine. Ian Morris is at the LSE tomorrow evening giving a lecture on Each Age Gets the Great Powers It Needs. And Deirdre McCluskey will be in a discussion on politics, economics and protest at the National Theatre on Wednesday evening. The final book in her trilogy, The Bourgeois Era, will be published in April. Next week, Tom Sutcliffe on the life and death of buildings, music and language. But now, thank you and goodbye.